And also in our headlines, a Palestinian ambassador to the UN during a General Assembly meeting slams the Israeli regime for committing ethnic cleansing in Gaza. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story, the Syrian army says it has inflicted heavy losses on terrorists as fierce fighting continues between government forces and foreign-backed Takfiri groups in the northwestern parts of the Arab country. The army has reported the killing of several members of an outfit called Al-Asab al-Hamra in the northern outskirts of Hama province. The group is affiliated to the Al-Qaeda-linked Tahrir al-Sham terrorist organization. The army also pushed back terrorists from the Jabal Zain al-Abidin area, bringing relative calm there. Separately, joint Syrian-Russian airstrikes, as well as shelling targeted terrorist hideouts in the Hama countryside, killing at least 300 terrorists and destroying their equipment, including drones. They've also intensified strikes on the southern part of Idlib province. Meanwhile, the Syrian army denied reports about entry of terrorists into the city of Hama. According to the Syrian media, at least 1,600 terrorists have been killed since the beginning of the military operations. Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi has reaffirmed his country's support for Syria in its fight against foreign-backed terrorists. Araghchi reiterated the pledge and clarified Tehran's stance on Syria during a phone call with his Egyptian counterpart, Badr Abdelati. While discussing regional developments, the top Iranian diplomat warned that the resurgence of terrorist groups in Syria and their possible spillover poses a serious threat to regional peace, stability, and security. He said that there is an urgent need for key regional players to keep up diplomatic efforts and engage in consultations to address the terror threat. Abdelati, in harmony with Iranian foreign minister, emphasized Cairo's policy of supporting Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity. The Israeli regime presses ahead with its genocidal war across the Gaza Strip, killing nearly 50 civilians in two massacres in the center and south of the blockaded territory. One of the regime's strikes killed at least 25 Palestinians when several homes were hit in the center of Gaza City. An Israeli drone also targeted civilians near the Al-Shifa Tower west of the city, killing several civilians. In central Gaza, five people were killed and nearly 40 injured after Israeli bombing of an entire residential block in the Nusayrat refugee camp. An earlier strike on the displaced people's tents in Al-Mawasi area in the southern city of Khan Yunis killed at least 20 civilians, including many children. The fatalities came after Israeli warplanes targeted makeshift camps in an area designated as a so-called humanitarian zone by the regime. Israeli forces also targeted the Abu Tammam school in Beit Lahia, killing and injuring several civilians. The new massacres increased the death toll from the Israeli genocide to over 44,500, leaving more than 105,000 people wounded. Faced with major food shortages amid Israeli restrictions on aid, many Palestinian families in the southern Gaza Strip are unable to feed their children. Footage shows displaced men, women, and children are queuing up in front of a charity kitchen in the hope of getting a meal. Let's take a listen to some of the Gazans who are striving for survival.
For a week now, with the closure of the crossings and the occupation preventing the entry of basic supplies, along with the closure of the world's central kitchen, the burden and pressure on us have increased. We had to double the cooking multiple times. People are also coming to us in increasing numbers. These families are unable to buy ingredients for cooking and are now completely dependent on this soup kitchen for food. Famine is beginning to appear here in the southern Gaza Strip. These families can't afford even the low-priced ingredients and have no source of food except from this charity. Currently, we are serving more than 800 families.
Concerning food, drinks, and gas, there is nothing. Life is completely at a standstill. As you can see, people here arrived from 8 a.m. to secure a lunch meal. Families can't afford to prepare lunch for their children. Some have 7, 8, or 10 children. The meal they receive here is their breakfast, lunch, and dinner because there are no soup kitchens left. Soup kitchens have closed because there are no food supplies. And if you find any, you find it at very expensive.
International calls are getting louder to stop the ongoing Israeli genocide in Gaza. Now more than 1,000 scientists, mainly psychologists and neuroscientists from around the world, have signed an open letter to demand an end to the bloodshed in the Palestinian territory. Scientists from different backgrounds, including Nobel laureates, called for a ceasefire in Gaza and urged the international community to pile up pressure on the regime to comply with humanitarian law. The letter condemns the violence committed, including what it called countless war crimes by Israel in the besieged Palestinian territory. The scientists warned that without international pressure, perpetrators feel emboldened to carry out more crimes, perpetuating hatred and violence. The letter was started by researchers at the Sorbonne University in France and Princeton in the U.S. and was published online. Well, the UN General Assembly has held a meeting to discuss the Gaza Strip amid Israel's ongoing bloodshed there. During the meeting, the Palestinian envoy to the UN slammed what he called ethnic cleansing in broad daylight by the Israeli regime. Let's take a listen to an excerpt of his address.
Ethnic cleansing is being carried out in broad daylight in Beit Lahia and all of northern Gaza. As I stand here, displaced families were bombed yet again in tents in Al-Mawasi, burned alive, while the whole world is watching. The arrest warrants issued by the ICC must be a turning point, the beginning of the end of this impunity, of finally holding criminal perpetrators accountable and upholding the rule of law, of protecting civilians and achieving justice for victims, of stopping ongoing crimes and deterring future crimes. There is only one way to stop this genocide and to save lives, and to free prisoners and hostages, and to preserve the hope of a different future. We all know this. It is an immediate, unconditional, and permanent ceasefire. It is what we have been calling for every day for 14 months.
Yemen's capital Sana'a hosted a military parade. At its renowned university, hundreds of students took part in the Al-Aqsa flood military courses, highlighting the country's growing mobilization against the United States and its allies. The event also showcased Yemen's solidarity with resistance forces in Gaza. Abdul Latif Al-Washali reports from Sana'a.
At Sana'a University, a sense of defiance and determination filled the air. Hundreds of students, graduates of the Al-Aqsa Flood military courses, marched in formation, demonstrating their readiness to join Yemen's armed forces.
We, the students of Sana'a University, have rallied today in response to the leader's call. May God protect him, and in solidarity with the oppressed people in Palestine and Lebanon and around the world. As the voice of freedom, we declare our readiness to fight this enemy until the day of judgment, generation after generation. We will not yield, standing firm like the mountains.
The parade was not just a display of discipline, but a statement of intent. It emphasized Yemen's ongoing mobilization and what it describes as the struggle against the United States and its allies, including Britain and Israel. Participants reaffirmed their commitment to defending the oppressed people of Gaza, who are enduring what they described a brutal Israeli war backed by the United States and Britain.
From Sana'a University, we send a message to the whole world and to the forces of evil, America, Britain, and Israel, that all members of Sana'a University, employees, academics, and students are ready to confront the enemies and wherever the axis of resistance requires. We are prepared to sacrifice and will not abandon Palestine at any cost.
This event comes amidst rising tensions in the region. The Yemeni army has vowed to intensify operations against the U.S. Navy and Israeli-occupied territories, framing these moves as retaliation for America's complicity in Israel's genocide in Gaza.
In Yemen, this parade is a powerful demonstration of both military strength and ideological resolve, highlighting Yemen's growing significance in regional conflicts. Amid the ongoing Israeli genocide war on Gaza, Yemen's message is clear. It is ready to intensify its resistance against the occupying regime. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The Yemeni armed forces, in collaboration with Iraqi Islamic Resistance, have conducted 3 successful military operations targeting Israeli positions within the last 48 hours in a show of unity and resistance. Yusuf Mowry reports from Sana'a.
The Yemeni armed forces, in cooperation with the Iraqi Islamic Resistance, have intensified their military operations against Israel, striking strategic locations in occupied Palestine. Yemeni military officials confirmed in a statement that 3 separate operations were successfully conducted, achieving their intended objectives. 2 of these operations targeted key Israeli facilities in northern occupied Palestine through a coordinated drone attack. The operation hit a vital installation in the Umar Rashrash area in southern occupied Palestine. These recent operations are described as a direct response to Israel's ongoing aggression and the catastrophic siege on Gaza, which has resulted in widespread destruction and loss of life.
Our operations are in steadfast support of Gaza, Lebanon, and Syria. The leader of Ansar Allah has made it clear that we will escalate our attacks against Israel, both by air and at sea. These military actions aim to counter all Zionist schemes in the region. As we have observed, the Zionists have opened a new front in Syria through their proxies.
Yemen has categorically rejected any possibility of a ceasefire agreement with Israel or its allies, emphasizing that Islamic principles guide their decision to prioritize military resistance as the only acceptable path forward. The stance reflects Yemen's firm commitment to strengthening its regional armed resistance network.
Our Islamic faith and beliefs compel us to continue our military and jihadi efforts as long as oppression persists. This is why our joint military operations with the Islamic Resistance in Iraq will not only continue but will intensify as Zionist aggression escalates. The battlefield will demonstrate the effectiveness of our unity and resolve.
Since the onset of the genocide in Gaza, Yemen has emerged as a formidable regional power capable of projecting its influence and imposing naval deterrence on adversaries through its strategic control of key waterways. In response to threats by the U.S. president-elect to the Hamas resistance movement to release the Israeli captives by January 20, Yemeni officials have issued a sharp rebuttal, asserting that Washington and its allies will be the ones who should pay a heavy price in West Asia if the genocide in Gaza continues. Yusuf Mowry, Sana'a.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol had his decree of martial law quickly struck down by lawmakers amid chaos at the country's National Assembly. President Yoon hours later accepted the lawmakers' decision, plunging the country into sudden political crisis. President Yoon now may face impeachment and possibly even charges of treason. Frank Smith reports from the South Korean capital, Seoul.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol decreed martial law late Tuesday, citing anti-state moves and threats aimed at undermining his government's authority.
I hereby declare an emergency martial law in order to defend the Free Republic of Korea from the threat of North Korean communist forces and to eradicate the shameless pro-North anti-state forces that are depriving our people of their freedom and happiness.
Lawmakers then raced to the National Assembly, avoided forces deployed to implement martial law, and voted to overrule the president. Hours later, Yoon accepted the ruling lifting martial law. Democratic Party leaders, however, warned the political crisis is not over yet. President Yoon's shock bid has left South Koreans anxious about the fallout from the political instability in the country. Some have called his moves to consolidate power a treasonous coup attempt.
Yoon Suk-yeol was under immense pressure. His popularity rate was really low, and there were even corruption allegations against his wife. So I think that he probably acted out of desperation. He tried to distract the attention towards a different topic, and I think that's why he did it. And probably he thought he would survive it, but to be honest, I think his move has really backfired.
6 progressive parties Wednesday submitted a proposal to impeach President Yoon. And if a two-thirds majority of lawmakers pass that measure, Yoon could face immediate suspension from office.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol's political gambit seems to have failed quite dramatically. For many, now the debate is only how long he will remain the president before resigning or being forced from office. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The probability of nuclear wars and threats from nuclear-armed countries seems to be growing. A report on nuclear weapons spending released this year shows the United States at the top, with its share of total spending being more than all the other nuclear-armed countries combined. The figure has sparked fears of something bigger than what it seemed. Rachel Hamdoun has more on the story from New York.
The U.S. spent the largest amount of money on its nuclear weapons among nine nuclear-armed powers, even though it does not have the largest nuclear arsenal. It does, however, have a soaring rate of homelessness, unemployment, and hurricane damage, but it continues to be that funding by taxpayer money ends up in foreign wars and weaponry killing civilians. Contractors who produce the parts needed to build nuclear weapons profit the most, the same way they do by supplying arms to Israel for its genocidal war on Gaza. Ironically, U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham and Representative Tim Walberg stated that Gaza needs to be treated the same as Hiroshima and Nagasaki. As if the amount of destruction is not enough, so nuclear war is what's left. In an interview with the program coordinator for the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, Susie Snyder, who is also one of the authors of a recent report on the nuclear spending, she explains more.
So $51.5 billion spent by the United States in 2023 on their nuclear weapons, designed to destroy cities, designed to violate the rules of international humanitarian law, the laws of war, if they're ever used. If there is a nuclear conflict, it will change life for every person on this planet. There is no one that would not be affected. And they could be affected by the direct conflict where the bomb goes off. There's the immediate, you know, the immediate blast, the fireball. There's the delayed impact of radiation, those intergenerational harm.
Nuclear weapons violate international humanitarian law like distinction, proportionality, means of warfare, and environmental protection. Although the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons bans any threat of nuclear war, technological advancement seems to counter that, and its dramatization, such as last year's Oppenheimer film, may only end up normalizing the devastating consequences that will carry on through generations. It remains crystal clear that U.S. spending on foreign wars and matters is much larger than spending on domestic concerns such as homelessness and healthcare. It must also not be forgotten that the Israeli regime denying any nuclear stock threatened to nuke Gaza, while a U.S. senator warned that Hiroshima and Nagasaki should be a lesson for Gaza. How much of a coincidence is this? Rachel Hamdoun, New York.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him, has said, "Whoever remembers us to Ahlul Bayt and his or her eyes fills with tears, his or her face will never burn in the fire of hell."
in the limelight.
The Confederation of British Industry, the CBI, has said growth expectations among British firms has taken a decisive turn for the worse. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Growth expectations among United Kingdom companies have taken a decisive turn for the worse in a fresh blow to Rachel Reeves, amid warnings that business confidence has plummeted since the budget. For the first time this year, expectations for growth have turned negative, according to the Confederation of British Industries, CBI's latest growth indicator, which shows that a majority of companies expect activity to decline in the 3 months to February. Business volumes in the services sector are anticipated to decline, including in consumer services, with more firms in the business and professional service sectors expecting a drop in activity than a rise in the next 3 months. The gloomier outlook comes as private sector activity declined again in the 3 months to November, according to the Confederation of British Industry, the CBI, with all three major sectors, services, manufacturing, and wholesale and retail, reporting falling business volumes, sales or output. The Chancellor Rachel Reeves's budget at the end of October contained £40 billion of tax rises, including £25 billion from increasing the national insurance contributions paid by companies. The Chancellor has said the decisions were necessary to stabilise the public finances and fund better public services. Alpesh Palleja, the CBI's interim deputy chief economist, said, "As we head into 2025, expectations for growth have taken a decisive turn for the worse. Our survey suggests that anticipated activity was already weakening heading into October budget, and the Chancellor's announcements have left businesses with even more tough choices to make. News that firms are planning to reduce headcount is a real concern, with hiring intentions at their weakest since the tail end of the COVID-19 pandemic. This could be an early sign of the impact of higher labour costs from the upcoming rise in employer national insurance contributions and the uprating in the national living wage." The CBI is calling on the government to move quickly and decisively to reform business rates, deliver apprenticeship levy flexibility, and boost occupational health incentives to support the health of the workforce. Business leaders are worried about the British government's ability to achieve growth over the next 5 years. The London Chamber of Commerce and Industry said it acknowledged the government's need to take tough decisions to help repair public finances, but believes the policies announced in the budget and employment rights bill created a perfect storm for businesses in the capital. It said the government would be unable to achieve the long-term growth it has made a cornerstone of its strategy. About 81% of business leaders who are members of the Chamber of Commerce and Industry said they were not confident that the government would listen to and address concerns from the business community, and 77% were not confident that the government would succeed in its commitment to economic growth. Business confidence has plunged to its lowest levels since the early months of the COVID-19 pandemic, according to a separate report from the Institute of Directors at the weekend. Its Economic Confidence Index, which measures business leaders' optimism in prospects for the British economy, fell to minus 65 in November from minus 52 in October, the fourth monthly fall in a row. That is the lowest reading since the record low of minus 69 in April of 2020. The London Chamber of Commerce and Industries SNAP survey of more than 200 business leaders showed almost four-fifths of businesses of all sizes said that increased employer national insurance contributions would negatively or very negatively affect their business, leading to almost half predicting a hiring freeze and lower pay for staff in the coming years. Firms also are concerned about the Employment Rights Bill, with 38% predicting the changes will mean a hiring freeze, while 16% warned it will lead to job losses. Just over three-quarters feel that the government has not meaningfully engaged with businesses on the measures, which include protection against unfair dismissal for employees from day one, a universal entitlement to sick pay from the first day of illness, changes to the minimum wage and giving more than 1 million people on zero-hours contracts the right to gain guaranteed working hours if they want them. Karim Fatehi, the chief executive of London Chamber, said, "This SNAP survey has confirmed our worst fears. The business community views the combined package of increased employer national insurance contributions, cuts to business rates relief, and the Employment Rights Bill as a serious threat to their operations over the coming years. It also shows that London businesses are fast losing faith in the government's economic growth strategy. Having weathered a cost of living crisis, soaring inflation, higher borrowing costs, and trade tensions, businesses need operating conditions conducive to economic growth, rather than measures that curtail their ability to invest in their businesses, hire new people, and train their staff. Family businesses are worried about changes to inheritance tax, with just over a fifth saying they were likely to wind up their family businesses instead of passing them on, according to the London Chamber of Commerce and Industry survey. Weighing in on the IHT debate, research for the CBI's economic consultancy found that the decision to cap business property relief at £1 million could lead to more than 125,000 job losses in the coming years and lead to a significant reduction in economic activity and lower tax revenues. The study, on behalf of the group Family Business UK, calculated that the measure would also reduce the value of goods and services produced across the economy by £9.4 billion. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story and tells us more. The outlook for the British economy was taken a decisive turn for the worse since the budget, according to Business. In just the latest sign of the potential damage done by the Chancellor's £40 billion tax bombshell, a survey by the Confederation of British Industry, CBI, found private sector firms believe activity will fall in the next 3 months. This marks the first time this year that expectations have been negative and comes as business reels from a punishing budget that included a £25 billion rise in national insurance contributions paid by employers. Critics argued that increase breached Labour's manifesto pledge not to raise national insurance. The hike came alongside an inflation-busting rise in the minimum wage, higher business rate bills and a new package of rights for workers that could cost the private sector more than £5 billion a year. Alpesh Palleja, interim deputy chief economist at the Confederation of British Industry, CBI, said, "As we head into 2025, expectations for growth have taken a decisive turn for the worse. Our survey suggests that anticipated activity was already weakening heading into the October budget, and the Chancellor's announcement have left businesses with even more tough choices to make." The CBI warned that companies are now planning to cut jobs as they grapple with higher costs and a tepid outlook for the economy. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has warned that the national insurance rates, alongside the increase in the minimum wage, will prove particularly damaging. Despite previously branding national insurance as a jobs tax that makes it more expensive to hire new staff, Rachel Reeves raised the levy paid by employers from 13.8% to 15% and cut the threshold at which firms start paying it from £9,100 to £5,000 a year. Mr. Pallegia added, news that firms are planning to reduce headcount is a concern, with hiring intentions at their weakest since the tail end of the COVID-19 pandemic. This could be an early sign of the impact of higher labour costs from the upcoming rise in employer national insurance contributions and the uprating in the national living wage. The Chancellor has faced a ferocious backlash from businesses over the budget, with more than 80 major retailers, including Marks & Spencer's, Tesco's and Currys, warning the £7 billion hit facing the industry will result in store closures, job losses and higher prices.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Everyone. The Israeli regime has now been murdering women and children of Gaza for over 425 days. Those who escape the horrors of bombing and shelling succumb to the elements, disease, and starvation. How much more ruthless, barbaric, and cruel can the Zionist entity become is anyone's guess. And we have long been taught that a warrior fights a warrior, not a mother and child, not a doctor or a patient, nor a journalist. A warrior does not bomb hospitals, aid workers, or food distribution centers, but it seems leadership in Tel Aviv never got that memo. This protracted Gaza genocide is the focus of this edition of your Spotlight. And now for our guests. Mr. Khaled Barakat, spokesperson at the Masar Badil movement, joining us from Beirut. Efrahim Mohammed, broadcaster and commentator, joining us from London. Hello, and I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we'll do the gentlemanly thing, if we can, Mr. Khaled, and start with Ms. Fahima Mohammed there joining us out of London. Fahima, winter, you very well know, is upon us. And while hungry Gaza families, they're huddling around open fires, many in shelters in the outside amidst the rubble with little hope for the future. What explanation do we, as the people of the world, half for Gazan families, why we have been unable to put an end to this nightmare for them?
Well, I guess we have to start by looking at it from a macro perspective rather than just the micro and the humanitarian disaster that is carrying on. And unfortunately, they are paying the heaviest price for the fact that Israel has failed to destroy Hamas. It has failed to destroy Hezbollah. It has failed to It has failed to change the face of the region. It has also internationally image which has been destroyed. It is unstable internally, socially, economically, and institutionally, and its military has been humiliated. So this ongoing conflict will continue regardless of, even as you mentioned, of the international law and the humanitarian that we need to see, which would apply to majority of the world, but of course it does not apply for having any consequences for Israel crossing any red lines. There is no safe zone in the, you know, the Gaza Strip. There is no sort of rest for anyone. They have been displaced for weeks. Hospitals are not just the targets, schools and refugee camps, but now it's even the targeting of aid distribution, where you probably also have mentioned in your report that children have been killed while waiting for hours for food. And it's been many reports that children have been not just targeted because of the carpet bombing for these tents that have been put up in the winter, where there's nothing else left for them to stay in, but also the children has been sniped in the head, the neck, and the chest. So with the Israeli sort of precision targeting, they unfortunately are unleashing their anger for the actual the point that they have failed in so many areas and have, you know, used up so much billions of dollars of the US. And now with Trump coming in January with his threat as well, they are doing the most damage that they can continuously day after day until that point, even though it's going to be where Trump will probably still make a deal in order to ensure Israel's security first and what they prefer, but at the same time, for it to have some sort of, you know, pressure from the UN as well, for them to, you know, see that there are sort of humanitarian aid coming in, and the fact that there is huge public worldwide uproar that they need to do something, because at the end of the day, nothing seems to be working for Israel when it comes from their point of view of actually winning or achieving anything.
Okay, thank you. And Mr. Khalid Barakat, thank you for your patience. Welcome to the program. Moments ago, I'm pretty well sure you're following the news, the Al-Mawasi camp was bombed by the Israelis. At least 20 Palestinians, many of them women and children, were killed, dozens wounded. This is just moments before this program started. Sir, tell us your initial thoughts on why still, after 425 days, every night, hungry Gazan families go to sleep not knowing if they're going to live through the night.
Yes, well, the Zionist regime want us to get used to this scene and that this is normal life for Palestinians in Gaza, and as if we have to accept this genocide, normalizing genocide, normalizing war crimes. And every day, as your coverage in Press TV on a daily basis since October 7th, you have been also asking this question, is until when Israel is going to get away with all these crimes. Now the entire world knows about this. This is not news anymore in terms of what Israel is doing. The most important thing, in my view, is that why Israel could get away with all these crimes, who is behind Israel and this Zionist criminal regime. And that is, this genocide is taking place with the full support of the United States, France, Britain, Germany, and the Western, you know, colonizing imperialist powers. It is also, Israel is getting away with these crimes because of the silence of the vast majority of the Muslim countries and Arab regimes, with the exception of the few, with the exception of Iran. The rest of these regimes are actually divided between, you know, complicit in the crimes or not having the will to support the Palestinian people. And in this regards, you know, Egypt comes in mind, because the Egyptian regime is both complicit and at the same time participating in the siege against the Palestinian people for the past two decades, especially these days. And the Egyptian regime is playing a role in assisting Israel in a way or another by not opening Rafah crossing, by not allowing aid and medicine, water to enter the Strip. because what's happening is that Israel is slaughtering Palestinians who are being in prison when they can't leave Gaza, and they are constantly being bombed. And that's why even Israel allies cannot anymore justify these crimes. And as we know, the ICC, the International Criminal Court, have issued a warrant arrest against Netanyahu and Gallant, and also it's going to issue more warrants against Israeli, you know, generals and politicians. Now, the international community have failed miserably in acting in a real way and in a responsible way. Gaza have exposed the balance of power that is guiding today. Global, balance of power. The United States wants to impose its own laws, and it has been blocking any real efforts in terms of stopping the genocide, whether it's Biden administration or the upcoming administration with Trump. It's not going to have any real change in terms of the United States imposing its hegemony over the region. But at the same time, we have to look at the other picture, and that is the steadfastness of the Palestinian people in Gaza and the Palestinian armed resistance, who until today is capable to stand against the Israeli war machine and making Israel objectives failing, failing. Israel failed in terms of like bringing Palestinians to surrender. They failed in terms of ending the resistance and Hamas and other resistance groups, and also Israel failed in terms of releasing the Israeli prisoners captured by the resistance. So Israel have been exposed and they failed. What they did is they killed and destroyed Gaza.
Thank you for your initial comments there, Mr. Barakat. Ms. Mohammed, I'm glad Mr. Barakat mentioned the U.S., and I'm particularly glad he mentioned Donald Trump, because just yesterday, U.S. President-elect Donald Trump made a serious threat. He said if Hamas doesn't release the hostages, there will be hell to pay. I want to know, what have Palestinians been paying then for the last 14 months with U.S. bombs, U.S. missiles, and U.S. basically made drones raining down a nightmare on their heads, on Gazan families, for well over 14 months now?
Well, they're not going to look at it from that sort of perspective, unfortunately. We know that the Israeli lobbyist groups, not just in the US, but also in the UK and across the globe, has heavily influenced even the sort of political powers. And they have also have a new cabinet that's upcoming that will definitely be even stronger in sort of stance for Israel. We have to obviously, you know, say it as it is, that Palestinians, unfortunately, are not looked upon as equal for anyone to give them that equal right. Even these sort of like, you know, humanitarian concerns that are out there from big organizations, and like I said before, for the rest of the world that would apply, but it doesn't apply to the Palestinians. Even when there are, you know, hundreds of voters, it's one veto from the US, and that just says that they have another agenda, which is nothing to do with the people. And it seems like, you know, they don't really have any excuse but the fact that it is there to just make sure that Israel has, you know, the best of the best support in every way possible, and excusing anything that they have done wrong. But even in Israel itself, we have the former Ministry of Defense actually stating that what's happening in Gaza is actually an ethnic cleansing. So their own people are uprising, and that's why they are very strict on even not allowing any journalists, and not allowing, not just to also say what's been happening in Gaza, but actually in Tel Aviv itself, its own journalists cannot actually say anything. One of its own press has also been told to, I think it was the Haaretz, that they were also held as limiting their kind of stories, because they were posting things that was against Israel's sort of everyday dealings with regards to its military, as well as its Netanyahu you know, dragging its feet and not actually even worrying about the hostages from the Israeli side. That's what they're saying. There are protests that are happening every day. There are many millions of people that have actually left Israel. There is no such thing as any sort of economic stability. In fact, it has gone so down that people are even scared to even be in the military. They are actually forcing even the extreme Orthodox Jews to actually partake in the military, which has never been before in history. So they are really suffering themselves, and they want to hide that. And obviously, looking outside from the West, they obviously have invested so much, so they have to continue with this to see themselves as a winner. Otherwise, their own country will have even more of an uproar, because all of that would have gone to waste. So they cannot finish right now from their perspective unless they see what they feel that they can do, which is actually taking over, which is what Netanyahu stood up in the UN before even October the 7th with a map, actually not even having Gaza in the actual existence there. So they have, you know, their agendas, which has been mentioned. Yes, it is unfortunately that everyday people are paying the price for this in the most extreme way possible. And majority of it is children, women, elderly. They have, you know, reports every single day saying that, you know, they're hovering over them with regards to the military, whether it's the drones or the flights, the planes that are there, just, you know, not giving them even a peace to sleep. So there is psychological warfare. There is there to sort of break them down, because they are very strong and they have been through this for generations and decades. But it's still not an excuse for them to violate every single international law that there is and still get away with it.
And I'd like to put that same question to Mr. Barakat. When it comes to this threat by U.S. President-elect Donald Trump, there have been deals, there have been proposals, U.S. proposals, for a permanent ceasefire, for a captives release deal, but the Israelis refused to accept it. I mean, how's the onus on Palestinians, sir, at this point? Is the only deal that's acceptable to the leadership in Tel Aviv and in Washington is to have Palestinians basically give back the captives and lose control and ownership of Gaza?
Yeah, that's a very good question. But for us Palestinians, we feel that the Zionist regime is also paying a price, and in its depleting in its economic strength, its position in the region, its position worldwide, the image of Israel today and the nature of this Zionist colonialist regime has been exposed. Israel, in terms of its strategic position and goals, even on the normalization front or being the hegemonic power in the region, is also in crisis. What we are witnessing is a regime who is living an existentialist crisis, not just administrating the war and the conflict with the Palestinian people and the region. And we see that when Israel launched its aggression against Lebanon, they realized that they were met with a very strong fierce resistance in Lebanon. And that's why they're trying to shuffle the cards. So, yes, things are happening in Gaza, but it's affecting the entire region. It's affecting Israel particularly, and not just the region. And, you know, when you look at the internal contradiction of the Israeli regime itself, you can see how they are divided. I don't see that the Palestinian people are divided. Palestinians across the board, they are behind their resistance, whether in Palestine or in the diaspora. Palestinians, the vast majority of Palestinians, support the resistance. And at the same time, yes, we are very angry and disappointed, but we're not demoralized, nor that we are going to, just accept any deal that Trump will offer. The Israeli regime have to release our political prisoners. The Israeli troops and occupation forces have to leave Gaza and withdraw from Gaza. There is no chance that for Zionists to come back to Gaza and try to, have these dreams of Smotrich and Ben-Gvir and all these war criminals to be able to build settlements and colonies in Gaza. This will not happen. And the Palestinian people will not allow the Zionist regime to build settlements in Gaza. If you look at what happened in the last 14 months, the Palestinian people in Gaza did not leave Gaza, and they actually could, if they want to. They did it twice in the past, where they just stormed the borders between Egypt and Palestine. But our people are conscious that the Israeli objective that Israel is not declaring is the displacement of the Palestinian people. And they are doing this with the support of the United States. This is very important, and we cannot stress this enough. No. Because the Palestinians are not just fighting Israel. The Palestinians are standing up against the NATO, against these Arab reactionary regimes. The Palestinian people are also not just fighting this powerful camp, they are also, even outside in the diaspora, they are being targeted daily by German police, by Canada's police. So it's not just Gaza, and it's not just the West Bank. The entire Palestinian people are engaged in this battle.
We're almost out of time. I want to get this last question out to Ms. Mohammed. Ms. Mohammed, earlier today, 157 countries joined a resolution in the General Assembly to organize a high-level conference aimed at creating an independent Palestinian state. There's only opposition from 8 members, the Israelis, the U.S., and a few of their cronies. Well, this resolution tells us two things: that most of the world, almost everyone in this world, believes that Palestinians deserve their own independent state. But more importantly, it also shows no one believes that Israel will ever give the Palestinians the right to self-determination, that they could be trusted to give the Palestinians their rights or their dignity that they deserve as a nation.
That may be true, but unfortunately, even with all of that, the reality is that the superpower, being the ally of Israel, the U.S., is too strong, and even if one veto, it does not go through, and we've seen that over and over again. So there is something that we need to understand, as much as the Palestinians have the resistance as a people, but even they are divided with regards to the political, whether it's the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, as well as Hamas in Gaza, and of course, you know, around the geopolitical areas as well, as we see in Syria at the moment. We have these different groups that have been rising up, which is also affiliated with the West and prompted by the West, actually, trying to create sort of sectarian sort of divide. But it's not that. It's the fact that, you know, at the end of the day, like, was mentioned before, you know, there is definitely sort of the fear of Israel not actually gaining what it actually wants. But they're trying in different areas and different movements. But unfortunately, the main powers and the main sort of players that actually do have control for making these decisions, including the Arab nation, has actually failed in the sense of actually, you know, standing by the Palestinians to actually make a difference, which they can, even if it was to actually, punish Israel for, you know, certain ways of not giving them aid or whatever it means, or even doing deals that they are at the moment, even aiding them in any way with regards to their military bases and things like that. But that's continuous. So unfortunately, even with the hundreds of people that are there, even in the UK, Labour has said that they would even recognise the Palestinian state. But as soon as, you know, they came into power, that was refuted, and again, it was ignored. So when it comes to the major players who actually can make a difference, unfortunately, it won't be seen through.
Thank you both. Time has gotten the better of us. Appreciate having you both join us on the program this evening. Mr. Khaled Barakat there, spokesperson for Masar Badil Movement, joining us from Beirut, and Ms. Fahima Mohammed, broadcaster and commentator, joining us out of London. And this brings us to the conclusion of this segment of your Spotlight. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This title given to the 11th Imam, Al-Askari, is because of a military camp.
Al-Kindi, he was a philosopher who lived during the time of Imam Hassan Al-Askari. When he gets there, he finds Imam moving towards a community who are anticipating him.
This is Dialogue, an introduction on the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Hassan al-Askari, alayhi salam. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Hassan al-Askari, alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Hassan ibn Ali al-Askari, alayhi salam, the father of the 12th divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Mahdi, was the 11th Imam of the Infallible Imams from the Ahlul Bayt of the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. The blessed and pious Imam carried the banner of Islam, undertook the goals of the religion, and sacrificed his life unto this way. He was indeed a fountainhead of knowledge and wisdom. He faced many incredible difficulties and tragedies and